Times wrote Mark Twain, reported prematurely be dead or dying. This ought not be surprising. An alliance of 16 sovereign and independent nations, each free to pursue its own and sometimes selfish interests, is going to find it constantly challenging to agree on difficult issues and maintain a sense of common purpose. What is surprising, and indeed without parallel in history, is that NATO member nations have always pulled together and reached agreement on the tough decisions, including during the worst days of the Cold War, when fear of a formidable adversary sometimes threatened to drive us apart as often as it brought us together. Ironically, the end of the Cold War led some critics to question whether NATO still had a future. Some claimed that we were searching artificially for new missions, such as peacekeeping and partnership with the countries of NATO's east. Others complained that we were not performing these new missions well, and the slogans directed at NATO, such as out of area or out of business, and Bosnia life or NATO debt. Well, I'm here today to tell you that NATO is very much in business in ways that would have been unthinkable even just 2 years ago. For the first time in our involvement in former Yugoslavia, we have finally had opportunity to show that NATO could make a difference. And now Sarajevo is free from shelling, and Bosnia, we hope, may be on the road of a peace to a peace settlement, which NATO may be asked to help implement. At the same time, we are moving forward to extend the blessings of peace and stability which NATO members have enjoyed for the past half century to the eastern part of Europe, both through the Partnership for Peace and through the eventual enlargement of the alliance to new members. But I am also here today to tell you that the next steps we will soon be taking on Bosnia, as well as the next steps we will be facing in the enlargement process, will not be easy. They will force us to move beyond the slogans and, as the American expression goes, to put our money where our mouth is. And that is because you can never buy peace and security on the cheap. Question, as ever, is whether we are willing to make the necessary investments in peace, now which can save us from having to make far more difficult choices and sacrifices down the road. In Bosnia, there is at last a glimmer of hope that this conflict, which we have been able to contain for 4 years, can now be brought to an end. Of course, it has not been easy to arrive at this point. It took a prolonged enforcement of the economic embargo at sea in order to persuade the leadership in Belgrade last year to accept contact group's peace plan and, in effect, to sue for peace. And it took even longer to persuade the intransigent Serbs of Bosnia, who plainly believed that the international community lacked the unity and will to use force decisively. And there was surely some reason for their attitude, given that United Nations forces in Bosnia were deployed strictly for humanitarian and peacekeeping purposes and were vulnerable to hostage-taking and retaliation in the event of NATO action from the air. Indeed, their vulnerability produced the system of the dual key, which severely limited the scope for the effective application of NATO air power. Even in the midst of these difficulties, however, we were learning important lessons for future crisis management operations. The folly of deploying neutral peacekeepings in a civil war, where there was no peace to keep. The impossibility of combining a peacekeeping effort on the ground with a peace enforcement mission in the air. The need for a clear and attainable mandate for the UN, as well as a sounder relationship between our two organizations, and the need for unity of command. Last month's operation, the Liberate Force, demonstrated that we had indeed learned these lessons well. It was preceded by redeployments of UN forces to more secure positions and the introduction for the first time in the conflict of combat-equipped and trained troops on the ground in the framework of the French-British-Dutch Rapid Reaction Force. And it was planned by UN and NATO military commanders working together, not so much with a dual key as with a single purpose. The result was a textbook demonstration of the use of limited force in the service of diplomacy. Clausewitz would have been pleased. And the first significant sustained military operation in the history of the North Atlantic Alliance. I would argue that no other organization in the world could have used force so effectively and discriminately. We proved that NATO is not a blunt Cold War instrument, but that it can indeed be used flexibly on behalf of tightly controlled political objectives in the profoundly different and more complex security environment of post-Cold War era. However, it is not the moment for patting ourselves on the back. If the history of NATO since 1949 teaches us one thing, it is that we can go from crisis to success and yet still find ourselves tested yet again. We have managed to underpin Ambassador Holbrooke's negotiating efforts and help persuade the Bosnian Serbs to accept the territorial arrangements and principle of an independent Bosnia as envisaged by the contact group. The first time, peace is on the horizon and success is within reach. But there will be no peace in Bosnia and the Balkans, and perhaps no stability in the wider Europe, if NATO and its leading members, especially the United States, are not prepared to do their part in making this a reality. And it is simply a fact of life that NATO only functions well when the United States and Europe are together, as we demonstrated throughout the Cold War, the Gulf War, and during the recent air campaign in Bosnia. There were, of course, understandable reasons why we were not together at the start of this conflict. The American people were certainly not in the mood for another adventure just as the Gulf War came to a close. And so the United States gladly welcomed the Europeans' desire to take the lead. More fundamentally, neither Americans nor Europeans wanted to send ground forces to intervene in or to halt the conflict which followed the breakup of former Yugoslavia. Unfortunately, we failed to recognize the fact that former Yugoslavia was not some sideshow, but rather the main arena in which the rules of the game for the post-Cold War security order were being established. And so we went our separate ways, each side according to its own national perspectives, shaped by historical experience. At the risk of oversimplification, for the European allies, the haunting memory of the Balkans as the powder keg of Europe was paramount. Hence, the emphasis on humanitarian assistance and peacekeeping and the desire to avoid an intervention on one side which might fan rather than douse the flames of conflict. For the Americans, the emphasis was on the moral aspect and the desire to assist the victims of aggression, or through lifting the arms embargo, enable them to defend themselves. For 3 years, Europeans and Americans talked past each other. While the United States pressed for decisive action from the air, the European allies pointed to the dangers this would expose their peacekeepers on the ground, who indeed were taking casualties. The gap was only bridged this summer, when all allies concluded that before withdrawing and leaving the Balkan region to its fate, it was necessary to try robust action. But the current division of labor, with Europeans on the ground and Americans only in the air, is not something we can sustain. If we want to translate our success in Operation Deliberate Force into a permanent achievement, if we want to see both a secure and independent Bosnia and stability throughout the Balkans, we will need a NATO peace implementation force on the ground to make a settlement secure. I wish I could say that there was some easier, painless or cost-free way to reach our objectives, but there is none. For example, if we were simply to lift the arms embargo without sending a peace force, all the arms in the world would not enable the Bosnians to prevail against their more powerful and populous neighbors, and it would certainly not bring the conflict to an end. Quite the contrary. Nor can we avoid our responsibilities because we think a given peace agreement is less than perfect. We cannot allow perfection to become the enemy of the good. Our standard must rather be a peace agreement that is signed in good faith by all three parties and which provides for an independent, defensible, and viable Bosnian state within which the separate communities feel they can pursue their destiny safely and at peace with each other. I fully realize that in appealing for American participation in a peace implementation force, and I'm making this appeal today, it will be necessary to provide answers to a number of vital questions posed by the American Congress. And the first one of these is the most important. NATO troops will not be asked to go fight a war in the Balkans on behalf of one side against another. We will go in only if the Bosnian government is satisfied with the peace settlement and wants us there, and only if all the parties have signed and pledged to respect the agreement as well. That is a sine qua non for the operation, but it is not the only one. Let me be clear. This will be a NATO-led operation under NATO command and with robust rules of engagement. We will not go in on behalf of one side or with the idea that any party is our enemy, but we will prepare to deal swiftly and effectively with any local instances of non-compliance to the agreement. Indeed, it is better to go in with adequate force or not to go in at all. Finally, we will have an exit strategy. This will not be an open-ended commitment. This will not be intervention in a civil war, as in Vietnam. It will not be an exercise in nation-building, as in Somalia. Our mission will be limited in scope and duration. Essentially, we will oversee the pullback of forces to agreed demarcation lines and monitor the resulting zones of operation. We will give confidence and security to all the parties as they implement their new constitutional relationships and restore their economic ties to each other, and as international reconstruction efforts begin to go forward. And then we will leave. Again, I do not say that there will not be risks or costs to this operation, or that success is guaranteed. Indeed, I know that many Americans are asking why it is necessary for the United States to participate on the ground in such an operation. The answer, first of all, is that there will not be an independent Bosnia unless NATO does the job of securing the peace. And the war in Bosnia may spread and confront us with greater dangers if we do not bring it to an end. Now, second, the European allies do not have the resources, capabilities, and manpower to do the job alone. But neither will the U.S. be asked to do it alone. The allies will do their share on the ground, at sea, and in the air, as they have been doing for over 3 years now. And third, the United States cannot fail to participate in such an operation without doing real damage to NATO and to America's position in Europe. This alliance simply cannot but be affected if its leading member does not play a substantial role in an operation of such critical importance to the peace and stability in Europe and share equally in the burden of risks and responsibilities. And I would argue this alliance is too important to America's global role and strategic interests to allow it to be damaged. You may yet need a strong NATO in a world of so much uncertainty and instability. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, as I stated at the beginning of my remarks, we are now facing some tough decisions, not only on Bosnia, but also in relation to our democratic partners in Central and Eastern Europe and to Russia. It is one thing to proclaim the need to expand NATO membership, but it is something else altogether to assume the consequences. I believe, however, that we have an historic obligation to stabilize the area to NATO's east, which for generations has been treated as no man's land, a region where great powers clashed in their quest for influence and where local disputes often erupted into wider wars. If we can succeed in bringing the new democracies of Central and Eastern Europe into NATO's security community, we will achieve a double benefit. First, we will reduce future risks to our own security, and second, we will over time increase significantly the resources and capabilities available to NATO's collective defense and new missions, thus sharing the burdens more broadly. In other words, the enlargement of NATO is an exercise not in charity, but in enlightened self-interest. But to state firmly the principle of enlargement is not to imply that it can happen immediately or even easily. Enlargement only makes sense if new members are going to make a net contribution to our common defense as well as to NATO's new missions. In short, there must also be providers of security. Same time, NATO enlargement must not draw new dividing lines in Europe or be a means of giving security to some while others are left out in the cold. That is why the Partnership for Peace will even grow in importance after enlargement, because it will constitute the broadest possible security community for NATO members, non-members alike. And that is why we undertook a study on enlargement, whose results were presented to our cooperation partners in Brussels last week. The study points to the obligations that new members will have to assume in terms, for instance, of respecting democratic norms, providing adequate armed forces at NATO standard levels for the common defense, and also achieving civilian control over those armed forces. At the same time, the study underlines the costs and changes that NATO will face internally. NATO's Article 5, Security Guarantee, applies equally to all allies. So if we extend that guarantee, we have to mean it. The extension of an empty or half-hearted security guarantee will not only do nothing for Central and Eastern Europe, it will also mean the end of NATO, for once one ally's security is no longer the same as another's. The trust and solidarity on which NATO is based would soon crumble. So there is no cost-free enlargement option. We are right in asking prospective future members to prove their credentials by making efforts to meet certain standards. But we must be prepared to match their efforts with extra resources of our own. If it is thus in the interest of both sides, existing 16 allies, as well as those that wish to join NATO, that we do not rush prematurely into decisions on the who and when of NATO enlargement. This is a process which must be handled gradually and deliberately. Our cooperation partners who are interested as much as we in a strong, functioning NATO must take the time to analyze our enlargement study. In the next few days, we will be sending a NATO team to discuss the study in depth with them in their capitals. The results of those briefings will be then considered by NATO foreign ministers in December, who will have to decide on the way ahead. The enlargement of NATO, however valuable in its own right, is not in itself a panacea for a secure Europe. It makes no sense to extend protection for some if at the same time one is simply alienating others or making them into potential adversaries. That is why NATO has developed a parallel, equally important policy track to complement its eventual enlargement, namely partnership with Russia. Our offer of partnership with Russia is not intended as a consolation prize. It is a genuine offer which fully takes account of Russia's weight and size in European security and which gives Russia concrete benefits, benefits of a unique special relation with NATO for information exchange, consultations, and concrete cooperation with us. I recognize that the political climate for the positive development of NATO-Russia relations has not been good in recent weeks. Nonetheless, I truly believe that Russia has nothing to gain from isolating itself. Neither has it anything to fear from NATO enlargement, which is not directed against Russia. Indeed, a stable, democratic Central and Eastern Europe, whose defense and security policies are not nationally oriented, but rather firmly anchored in NATO's multinational integrated structures, is the best environment for Russia's own political and market economic reforms to succeed. And so I hope that as our cooperation with Russia begins to develop, this great nation will overcome its somewhat irrational suspicions of the alliance and understand better the true and profound nature of NATO's transformation over the past 6 years, certainly in treating Russia like a genuine partner and consulting openly and frequently with her, NATO will do all it can to accelerate this evolution. But the price of a close NATO-Russia relationship cannot be a Russian veto or droit de regard over our internal decision-making. Achieving both NATO's evolutionary enlargement and the strong NATO-Russia relationship simultaneously will not be easy. But there is no alternative to this dual-track policy, and the price is great indeed. European security order built not on a fragile balance of power, but on democratic values and a durable cooperation. We have a unique opportunity to begin building this security order now. It cannot be built without NATO, and that means it cannot be built without the active participation of the United States. After all, NATO is the embodiment of Americans' commitment to preserving the peace in Europe, preventing the recurrence of the horrible world wars which blighted the first half of this century. And I might add, NATO is essential to the security of the United States, since it provides you with loyal and capable allies willing to share in the burdens of international peace, as well as the infrastructure for military operations in Europe and beyond, including the Middle East. So therefore, let us start now in Bosnia, by bringing this conflict to an end. Let us do so with American and European allies standing shoulder to shoulder, as we have done all throughout the second half of this century. And let us do so with the help of our Central and East European partners, who want to contribute to a peace operation and demonstrate their commitment to our security community, and with the cooperation of Russia, so that we can show that it is possible for NATO and Russia to develop an equal partnership in the service of peace in Europe. Ladies and gentlemen, all of this can be done, provided that we have the wisdom and the will to face the tough decisions, as we have done so often in NATO's history. And I'm confident that we will, once again. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Klaus. We have a number of questions, kind of flooded with questions, so we'll try to group them in subject matter a bit. But first, some late-breaking news. CNN has learned two NATO jets on routine reconnaissance over northwest Bosnia today fired HARM missiles on Bosnia's Serb SAM anti-aircraft batteries after they were locked on by radar. Your comments, will this influence plans to restart enforcement of the no-fly zone?
I have no details on this news, but I can assure you that the very sophisticated anti-air defense system, which was controlled by the Bosnian Serbs, has been destroyed for an important part. Of course, I cannot assure that there are not longer some ground air missiles, and that can be the explanation. It shows, of course, that we are still taking risks in assuring our mandate we have accepted long time ago, namely the no-fly zone above Bosnia. Once again, I do not think that this incident is enough to declare here that we are taking the decision to start once again bombardments. Of course, as I've said before, what we need is from all the parties involved some clear signals that they are ready to accept a peace agreement. And this, of course, indicates that if we are going in with the peace implementation force, we need to do it in a robust way. There is no other solution. We cannot take risks.
If peacekeeping forces, including U.S. troops, are sent to Bosnia, how long will they have to stay there? And a related question, do you believe the American public and the U.S. Congress will have the will to send 25,000 U.S. ground troops to Bosnia?
The first question, I should say 9 to 12 months. because we think that you need this period in order to give the opportunity to some important nations supporting the Bosnian government to build up a serious army and to train troops with modern arms. The second question, I'm a little bit surprised by the figures I've seen in the press. 50,000, 25,000 American guys, I do not know for the moment. We have no peace treaty, we have no map. I can only tell you that our American, that our military authority, sorry, will only finalize a military concept at the end of this week. And afterwards, we hope that we will obtain more indications at that moment, they will develop this. But one thing is clear, we have the conviction that immediately after the signing of the peace treaty, peace implementation force is an absolute necessity. What does it mean? Well, it means that in the first days, of course, especially NATO and some non-NATO blue helmets will change their hats and become NATO-led troops with NATO rules of engagement, as I've said, and without any dual key obligation. But once again, it's very difficult to give any figure for the moment. We need to know more about the peace agreement and especially on the map.
Again, related questions. Can a peacekeeping mission to Bosnia succeed without Russia? And do you foresee a day when Russia is in NATO?
Frankly speaking, we believe that Russia has an important role to play in the peace process, as Russia is one of the permanent members of the Security Council and an important member of the contact group. And we think that it's up to Russia to play a role in the implementation of this peace agreement. We know that probably the Russians will not be ready to put their troops under NATO command. So some imagination will be necessary in order to find some structural links between both, but I believe that this is possible. Now, on the second question, as I've told you during my statement, we have never, and I have no secrets, we have never discussed, not in an informal, not in a formal way, the question who and when. So we have no secret list, a priority list on the first candidates, on a second wave. I can assure you that the Treaty of Washington is clear. Article 10 indicates clearly that it's up to the NATO Council, taking a decision as always at unanimity, to invite a nation or eventually several nations to join the alliance. This is only a signal for the Secretary General, who can start at that moment negotiation with that nation or with those nations. Let us suppose that the negotiations are successful. The result of the results of the negotiations will be the text of a treaty. And this treaty has to be ratified, not only by the parliaments of the 16 NATO nations, but I suppose by the parliaments of the candidates. That is the normal procedure. Now, concerning Russia, as I've said, we have no list at this moment. I do not know if our 16 foreign ministers will be ready during their December meeting to say to us, well, it's up to you to start now the study on the who and the when. I do not know. And secondly, as far as I know, a Russian membership to NATO is not at the Russian agenda too for the moment.
We have several questions on France. Will France rejoin NATO's integrated military structure, at least for the Bosnia peace enforcement? If not, won't NATO fall apart? And another question, do you think the French are justified in testing nuclear devices in 1995?
One thing is clear. It was a decision taken by NATO Council at 16 with France. France accepted a NATO-led operation. So France accepted for the peace implementation force, the leadership of our military authorities. There is no doubt. Is this a structural signal? I do not know. I have not had the opportunity to meet President Chirac, and so I do not know what his opinion is about the future relations between France and NATO. But I can tell you that especially on the non-Article 5 operations, crisis management, peacekeeping, France is taking all its responsibilities. I'm glad to tell you this. Now, on the nuclear tests, as you know, France does not belong to the integrated military structure. NATO, France does do not participate to the meetings of the defense ministers when we are discussing in the special nuclear group our problems. It's not up to France to give any explanation in NATO on its nuclear activities for the moment.
As NATO expands, does it not duplicate some of the missions of the UN, the European Union, and others?
My answer is negative. Of course, in widening security and peace to the East, we have not the ambition to do it on its own. We know very well that the security and the peace has several aspects. It is not only the military aspect, it is the political, the economic aspect. And so we think that the European Union has an important role to play, as the OSCE can play a more important role as today. So we are trying, of course, to coordinate our efforts. And of course, we will avoid a duplication of efforts. Because at certain moments, our partners are asking us for some assistance, for example, in the scientific and the environmental sector. A lot of partners, I can assure you, are facing very serious challenges concerning nuclear safety after the Russian troops left, and we are trying to help them. But once again, I think that a good cooperation between international institutions as the OSCE, as the European Union, and NATO can bring us to a security architecture for the whole of the continent of Europe, always in a transatlantic framework.
Can NATO forces be used in Algeria if Algeria seems to be going the way of Iran?
For the moment, no. Of course, our Ministerial Council gave us a new mission, namely to start some informal dialogue with Mediterranean countries. And so we started, as I said, in a very informal way, discussions with Morocco, Mauritania, Tunisia, Egypt, and Israel. I cannot exclude that the Council will even enlarge the list of those countries. First, feeling NATO was not very well known by those countries, especially not our political aspects, our third dimension, if I may say. So we did a good job. We are now listening to their priorities, and one cannot exclude that at a certain moment the ministerial meeting can come to the conclusion that a strengthening of the dialogue is a necessity. But for the moment, we are just in an informal procedure of discussion.
I don't know which table this came from, but let me read this. First, let me tell you, you have a full table of Belgian fans here. Now my question. You were introduced as the former president of the Belgian Socialist Party. In today's Europe, do you find this background an advantage to carry out your current responsibilities?
Now, as NATO Secretary General, I took immediately my responsibilities in order to avoid any confusion. So I have no longer links with any party in my country and not elsewhere. I've been president of the Social Democratic Party in Belgium from 75 to 77. And last years, indeed, I've been in the chair of the European Social Democratic Party. But as I've said, since I came to NATO, I think I have to maintain a strict, neutral political party, not to interfere in internal affairs, and especially not in the affairs of the political parties.
Here are a couple of questions that kind of conflict, which shows how difficult it is to answer them, perhaps. When the Serbs first called for ethnic cleansing, why did NATO not move decisively and powerfully to stop the war? Second question, didn't your bombing campaign simply bolster the Croat Muslim forces, open the way for a military reversal on the ground, and perpetuate the war?
I think that the first question is a very logical one. And as I have said during my statement, we have learned lessons in the past. We were linked to the UN by a dual key. At several occasions, we have asked UN for the permission to start stronger military actions. As I have explained, the UN, and especially the UNPROFOR generals, refused for reasons I can understand. I'm not criticizing those generals. They were responsible, of course, for their troops on the ground. And there was, indeed, a contradiction between peacekeeping on the ground and peace enforcement in the air. And only after the tragedy in some safe areas, as Srebrenica and Seba, the UNPROFOR generals accepted that more concentration of their troops was necessary in order to protect them, and they accepted the need for NATO to attack in a more strong way. We did not do it, especially against the Serbs, in order to help Croats or Muslims. But there is no doubt, if the safe areas, and the safe areas are not the result of a NATO decision, ladies and gentlemen, they are the result of a Security Council resolution. If those safe areas disappeared, it was the result of actions meant by the Bosnian Serbs. So it was normal that we were reacting against the Bosnian Serbs. Now, once again, we are not willing to go in war and to take positions in favor of one or other party. We are going to go in if the peace agreement is signed by the three parties involved in conflict in order to impose, if necessary, the peace. That's what we are willing to do, but I can assure you our last military activities, which were very successful, were based on a Security Council resolution, the 836, which was decided especially by the five permanent members, so even by Russia. Let this be clear.
We have time for one more question, but first I would like to present you with our club for your morning coffee.
Thank you.
And a certificate of appreciation. We enjoyed your visit. One final question. You say Russia has nothing to fear from enlargement. You also say the eastern region has been a no-man's land, subject to struggles for influence expansion through history. Aren't those two statements contradictory?
No, they are not. I do not believe that we can assure security and peace as long there is a gray zone in Central Europe. That's one. Secondly, finally, those states became democratic states. They can now implement all the rules of OSCE. And one of the fundamental rules of the OSCE is that in order to secure the future of a nation, the nation can choose freely its coalitions. So a lot of nations in Central and Eastern Europe are asking us for full membership. This is very democratic. Now, if I may add, I've said it during my statement, we are feeling a little bit unhappy because we are still presented as being the enemy, as was during the Cold War. We are acting just as the IMF, as the US, as the European Union, as the OECD, as other international organizations and nations, as Germany, trying to help those who are willing to consolidate the process of democratization and economic reforms in Russia. No less, no more. Now, because I can understand that some time is needed to convince as well the political, as the military class, as public opinion. But let me say this frankly. The more Russian personalities are making strong speeches against expansion, the more Central European countries are knocking at NATO door in order to accelerate the process of expansion. So I think that some positions taken by Russian authorities and speeches made are very counterproductive. And once again, let me say it very clearly, we have not at all any aggressive intention towards Russia. Russia is an important country in Europe. We need Russia in order to build up this security architecture. And we are ready to help them in develop their democracy and to reach better results in their economic reforms, together with other international institutions and with all the allies. So that's the reason why we are trying to convince all those having responsibilities in Russia that we have no secret aggressive intentions. If I may give you just one example, during the month of September, we have had 3 official meetings with Russia, the so-called 16 plus 1, the Council plus Russia. The first one in order to explain why we were acting in Bosnia and how we were doing. The second one in order to explain what proposals we were making in favor of Russia, having some difficulties in the implementation of the so-called CFE treaty, Conventional Disarmament Treaty, which is discussed in Vienna, where Russia is facing, if I understand well, difficulties as well at the southern as at the northern flank. We made proposals in order to show our willingness to cooperate. And finally, as I've told you, we have made last week an official way proposals in order to start so-called agreement on broad and enhanced dialogue, foreseeing as well mutual information as political consultation as even cooperation, especially in the field of security. So we are doing our utmost in order to prove by acts that we are willing to cooperate with Russia. And that's the reason why I'm still be optimistic. I think that finally we will make it together and that Russia will be a member of the big European family, opting for security and peace.
Thank you very much, Mr. Klaus. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Both of us are gone. We will make you.
That's it. We're coming.